Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
Before we dive into the show, I just want to add some late breaking news that was finalized after we recorded today's show. The Postmortem Podcast is going out not with a whimper, but a bang. Dread, Beyond Fest, and the American Cinematheque will be hosting our final show at the historic Egyptian Theater on Hollywood Boulevard, and you can be there in our live audience. Many of the Postmortem guests will be there on stage and in the audience on Saturday, December 9th. We'll follow the live show with a screening of Stephen King's Sleepwalkers for an unforgettable night. Tickets are available at the American Cinematheque's website, so I look forward to seeing you there. And now, on with the show. From Nice Sky Productions World Headquarters overlooking the glamorous San Fernando Valley, I'm Mick Garris, and this is the fun size edition of Postmortem AMA, where you can ask me anything, and asking your questions of me on your behalf is producer Joe Russo. And good morning, Joe. How are you? I have a feeling it's not going to be so fun sized today.
No, we have a lot of questions to get through, and not anything close to being the full mailbag, but we're going to do as many as we can because, Mick, this is the final Ask Mick Anything.
Yeah, we still have a couple more shows. We're going out with a bang. I won't tell everybody what kind of a bang yet, but It's a pretty spectacular finale. But as far as our AMAs go, this is the last opportunity to ask.
It's the last opportunity, but it's also the first opportunity we've had to talk about the fact that Postmortem is coming to an end since we've announced it, because you've been quite busy.
And we've been chock-a-block with guests
That's true.
AMAs.
We had our annual Halloween plethora of guests, and you were traveling, and so it's good to catch up with you again.
Likewise. Yeah, so this will be fun, and I have a feeling it's going to kick off with a morbid opening.
Yes. Mick, the question I've been getting from everyone when they hear that the show is ending is, are you dying?
Well, we all are we not?
In a way.
But no, I'm in excellent health. It's just that after 7 years with 180 interviews, I feel like it's mission accomplished. I think after 7 years, wrapping it up with the group of people that we've been able to talk to in every level of filmmaking has been so fulfilling and so rewarding. I don't want that to fade out. I want it to end with a bang, and all 7 years will continue to be available to anyone who's interested in our archives. Yes. So we've got, 180 interviews and a ton of AMAs that will always be out there, and conversations with the best and brightest within our genre.
I think it's safe to say that we put together probably one of the most impressive collection of interviews available, at least in the horror podcasting space.
Right.
There is, and it will continue to live on that way and probably be unrivaled for some time to come. And yeah, I think you have earned your podcast retirement, my friend.
yeah, I mean, we were holding out for winning a Rondo. And we got the Rondo Award this year for best podcast.
That's true. And, we're always a bridesmaid, never a bride until this year.
Yeah. So this is our valedictory lap. Yeah.
Yes. Best podcast of the year. Might as well go out on top. Well, shall we get into these questions?
Well, I also want to say I'm busy. You know, this has always been a sideline for me. You know, my main focus is as a writer and a producer and director. And I have projects in the works now that the strikes have been concluded, to be able to ride out the avalanche of projects that everybody's throwing at the studios and networks now, and to be able to pursue these things full time is also going to be something that's going to take more of a commitment than ever before.
Yeah, I think, you know, you and I have done a balancing act with our movie and TV careers while doing this show. And it will be nice to dedicate our full efforts to those things again.
Exactly.
Yep. Well, Shay, you want to do some of these questions? Because we got a lot.
Let's go to the next one.
All right.
Now that my death has been settled. Yeah.
That's right. First, from friend of the podcast, Dave Scout. Assuming Mick is not a narcotics courier, what's the deal with all the foreign travel? Do they pay his way just so he can be a horror ambassador of sorts? I can't imagine Mick is picking up all those flight tabs and hotel bills just to talk about critters, although Zeus knows that would be incredibly lucrative. What does Mick see as his international role as such, and how did he come to it?
Well, it is very strange to have become, without any attempt, a sort of international ambassador of horror. But I am unbelievably grateful and humbled to be invited by these festivals all around the world. They do pay my fare. They bring me over, and often they will show movies or television shows that I've made, do Q&As, do master classes, things like this all around the world. And it's an unbelievably generous opportunity for me to be able to see the world and to go to these places and realize that I have done work that is appreciated on an international level. And it's always surprising to me when I get one of these invitations, and I try to take as many of them as I can. Just because the more you travel, the more expansive your world becomes, and literally and metaphorically. So it's just been a great deal of fortune that I've had to be invited by these amazing collections of people who love genre cinema. And in a way, because my attitude towards our genre is so positive and encouraging, as evidenced by what we try and do on the podcast every week, it seems to have met with appreciation from the directors of these festivals around the world and in town. You know, I've been lucky enough to be invited to moderate conversations for Beyond Fest at the American Cinematheque, like the spectacular Roger Corman panel that we did. So it's something that, you know, I've been an interviewer since I was in high school. And that's been another facet of what I do. And it has led to me being invited to participate in these fantastic events.
You know, one of the only international things I was ever invited to was right before the pandemic. I got an invite to get my honorary PhD from a university in England.
Wow.
Except they had the wrong Joe Russo.
Gee, that never happens.
That never happens. But, you know, we really, really thought, wouldn't it be funny if we took a camera over and made a documentary about me accepting an honorary doctorate from the school that thought I was the other Joe Russo? But
they'd have loved that. Yeah.
The pandemic sadly squashed that that dream.
Damn.
Yeah, and I ended up forwarding it to him and doing the right thing. But anyway, I digress. It must be nice to be able to travel the world on other people's dimes.
it is pretty great. And to be invited to places I would not have thought of going to on my own. And I just came back from trips to Norway and to Finland. And, you know, it's just such a great experience. And I am grateful every day.
I said it on Twitter, but every time you brought up Helsinki, I kept thinking of that great Philip Seymour Hoffman monologue from that Sorkin movie. I can't think of the name of it off the top of my head, with Tom Hanks. But anyway, it's a great monologue about Helsinki. Anyway. okay. All right, moving on. Bryant writes, I'd be fascinated to know what Mick thought of the quote-unquote new Beatles song, both as a fan of the band and from an AI as a tool standpoint.
I thought it was great. I mean, you can't be my age, you can't have been in a band and not have been influenced by the Beatles in an enormous way. Not just the way people are influenced by bands today. If people don't recognize how unique the Beatles were and how vast their influence was socially as well as far as pop culture goes, just their music, they went way beyond that. They influenced everything in society in a way. It is an amazing video to see them brought together as they were, that could only be done with AI, and just the filmmaking techniques that Peter Jackson brought into this beautiful project. Truthfully, I was in tears. I mean, it just rips at your heart to see something that played such an important part of your life when you are becoming a human being. You know, when I was in junior high school when I first heard the Beatles, and I grew up with them in becoming an adult, and they became an important part of my life from that very beginning. And they changed my life and everybody else's life I knew.
It's pretty amazing. And in my opinion, how AI should be used as a tool.
Every tool has its good and bad uses. And this was a fantastic way to reconnect four personalities, two of whom have been dead for years, and to be able to do it with beauty and respect and inspiration.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what we want from artificial intelligence, not a cranked out Marvel movie. Okay. Neil asks, sticking on the Beatles subject for a second, he's got a two-parter because it's, you know, our last AMA. He asks, Mick, being a huge Beatles fan, do you have any plans to visit Liverpool in the future? And for me, Joe, any chance you could persuade Mick for a guest appearance to sit in the makeup chair and be a monster in one of your films in the future? So Mick, do you want to take the Beatles first?
I'll take the Beatles first because I have been to Liverpool.
Hey.
And I've been to the Cavern Club. And yeah, I made my journey to genuflect at their feet. And it was thrilling to do that. But I did that in 1980. And actually, no, I did it in 76, my first trip to England. I made the trek to Liverpool to see where Ground Zero was. And it was filled with inspiration and excitement. As far as sitting in the chair, go ahead, take it, Joe.
I mean, I'm always looking to pay homage to Mick in things. most recently, you know, I have a movie that's coming called Soulmates that I wrote. And in that movie, there's a high stakes karaoke scene. And we were desperately trying to get Don't Dream It's Over, specifically as an homage to Mick. And the stand. So absolutely, I would love to, if Mick would you know, accommodate, I would absolutely put Mick as a monster in something in the future.
I would happily undergo the process for my friend producer Joe, as long as it was not as extensive as the makeup I did on Michael Jackson's Thriller.
I mean, you'd hope in the 43 years there'd be some advancements, but
yeah, we could do it digitally. But Yeah, I had so much fun doing that. I am a bit claustrophobic, and getting a face cast and all that stuff was not the most fun in the world. And it was 3 hours in the makeup chair. However, they did replicate that makeup at a festival in Mexico City.
That's right.
Landis was there. And as a surprise, they made me up as my Thriller zombie. And I introduced Landis and a video, a drive-in theater screening of a new version of Thriller that had new elements cut into it, with the head of the festival, Pablo, made up as a Michael Jackson monster that they would cut back and forth.
Was the makeup process any faster or smoother than that?
Well, I didn't need my face cast, which helped. It probably took a couple hours, at least. It was a three-hour job on Thriller. But this was a couple hours, but it was a pretty good recreation.
Look, the great thing about Mick is if you stick him in as a cameo, you can't miss him. I can't. So many people tweeted at us when The Stand came out, the remake of The Stand came out, and they found you at the barbecue. So,
and if you blink, you miss me. I'm in there for like 3 seconds at the.
But they didn't miss you. it's those long locks.
Yeah. So,
all right.
You'll know I'm retiring if I ever cut it off.
Luis writes, "I've always wanted to ask a question and finally had the courage. Mick, when are you going to direct another feature? And Joe, are we ever going to get Blu-rays of the Beyond the Dark series and the Au Pair Nightmare? And can you guys send a shout out to my boys, Aiden and Jacob Camacho? They are 14 and 9 years old and just started to love the horror genre."
Aiden and Jacob, welcome to the dark side.
Yeah.
I think you're going to have a great time with it.
Absolutely.
I'm hoping to direct another feature. I have projects in the works right now. Right now, two of them are television oriented. One of them is a feature that I wrote and am producing, but I don't want to direct. It's an African American story that I think would be best directed by someone from the inside rather than from the outside. But I've written a 2-hour pilot and 9 story episode outlines for a series that is based on a story by Stephen King. And then Clive Barker and I, as we've talked about, have written a pilot together that was originally for Shudder, but that didn't work out. So now that the strikes have ended, all three of these projects will be rekindled and reactivated.
That's pretty awesome. And you know which story novel of yours I hope you will adapt and direct at some point.
Would that be Salome, perhaps?
That would be Salome.
Not a horror novel, by the way.
No.
Hollywood desert noir murder mystery.
Oh, be still my heart. to answer the second part of the question quickly, Beyond the Dark was, I think, always designed to just be a streaming digital release. I licensed a short film to that called Midnight Clear. And I don't really have much information with what they're going to do with that other than, you know, they put it on Shudder outside of that. And then the Au Pair Nightmare, I mean, I don't think they typically put TV movies on video anymore, which is a bummer, but you know, technically it's owned by, you know, one of our Nightmare Cinema producers, Nancy Leopardi. So I imagine if some, enterprising, DVD release company wanted to reach out and broker a deal, there's probably money to be made. So,
ride that wave of fandom.
I guess. We'll see. But, to be determined, I guess, on both would be the sad answer. But very exciting for Aiden and Jacob to start exploring horror. And they've got plenty of podcast episodes to go back and listen to.
That's right.
Kieran writes,
"Let us be your Alexandria library." Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay, next question. Kieran writes, "Mick, were you aware or consulted on the aspect ratio for the home video release of The Shining? And how do you feel about it being released overseas in 16:9 and not 4:3?
Well, what's interesting was The Stand came out in 1994, where there was no such thing as HD. The Shining was 97. We shot it in 35 millimeter film. We knew HD was coming and had actually already arrived, but ABC was not yet doing it. So we shot it in the 1:85 aspect ratio, but protected it for 4:3 television, the television standard at that time, which was, 4:3, as opposed to 1:85:1. Mm-hmm. So we knew that there would be a version that would be the, or actually it's 1:77:1 is the widescreen ratio of modern television. So we protected for that, and we protected for 4:3, but we always wanted it to look like a movie rather than a TV show. So I was involved in the transfer with the director of photography, Shelley Johnson. We always intended for there to be a theatrical format for this because of shooting it on 35 and because it was right during the birth of HD. We wanted it to be able to adapt to HD when it became commonplace.
Well, there you have it. He was involved. So, yeah. All right. Simon writes, "Hello, Mick and Joe. My question is, will there be a Nightmare Cinema 2 in the future? I love this anthology and can't wait for the second film."
Well, I think I speak for Joe and myself as being really proud of that movie. We made a movie that we could be excited about at a budget that was less expensive than anything I've ever worked on. And it turned out great. And it did really well on Shudder. The problem is it's really difficult to make a profit on an independent film. Mm-hmm. And especially this kind of independent film where the theatrical release was token at best, just so they could get a decent video deal. And then the video deal was not a particularly good one. It was very small time release on Blu-ray. So it had its biggest audience on Shudder. And Shudder has had anthology movies premiere on their channel that have had sequels made. At this point, it doesn't look likely. I would love for there to be one, but it's the question about whether there will be more of something that you are happy you made is a complicated one. Like people talk about, oh, I hate that there wasn't a Masters of Horror season 3. Can't we have one? Look, I would rather, and we've talked about this before, I'd rather celebrate the fact that we made Nightmare Cinema and that it came out great than bemoan the fact that there isn't a Nightmare Cinema 2. I don't rule out the possibility of Nightmare Cinema 2 happening, but the likelihood of it at this point in time is minimal. So let's celebrate the things that we've made that we can be proud of and not mourn the things that may or may not be wonderful in their wake.
Very well said. I will just add as well, like Tales from the Crypt, like Masters of Horror, Nightmare Cinema has a web of rights entanglements that also might make it financially untenable to produce a sequel, which has, I think, been probably the biggest thing standing in its way the last couple of years, and probably will continue to be. But
yeah, there's a lot of producers.
There's a lot of producers. But that doesn't mean that now that Mick and I have more time on our hands, that we couldn't explore a new anthology.
And we could definitely, just like for various reasons, including producer relationships and the like, I would not want to make more Masters of Horror. I do want to make more horror anthologies. And the project that Clive and I are working on, he created 10 all original new stories for this anthology idea that we're putting out there. And it's really exciting. And it would all be done in the UK if it's done the way it was intended. But I love anthology. It doesn't have to be the same format every time out.
That's absolutely right. So we'll see, I guess, is the answer.
Unlikely, but we'll see. Yeah.
This is a quick one addressed at me that we can knock off very quickly. Clay writes, producer Joe has a voice that sounds remarkably like Ben Witz, legal journalist, senior fellow at the Brookings Institute, and regular co-host of the Bulwark podcast with Charlie Sykes. Sometimes it's uncanny. Is there any chance they are the same person? Have you ever seen them in the room together? I listened to an episode of the podcast. I didn't hear it, but we are not the same person.
Well, that put that one to bed.
Yep, that is the answer, Clinton. I'm sorry to break it to you. I do not have a secret identity.
But the Bulwark is a good podcast, and Charlie Sykes is fascinating. I'm not as familiar with the other gentleman.
Yes, I was not either, but I do not think it sounds like me. But hey,
time to get into politics, Joe.
Nothing like 2024 to start. That's our new podcast, Mick.
Mick and Joe do your politics. New podcast, Joe.
All right. Randall writes, before the show ends, I have to ask once again about Mick's comparison between Stephen King and Clive Barker. I believe Mick said Stephen King writes about ordinary people in extraordinary situations, and Clive Barker writes about extraordinary people in extraordinary situations. Is that about right?
Well, it's kind of, but the main thing is that Stephen King sets his stories in a world we all live in and is very relatable, and then just nudges it into the supernatural. But it's a supernatural set in a very real and relatable world. And Barker creates magical worlds where he makes it feel real. So they approach it from opposite directions, but both of them with a sense of verisimilitude that feels genuine, that the humanity of both writers is massive. And Clive's characters, although set in a world like Imagica or any of the more fantastic, the Damnation Game, that enter into really fantastical worlds, they're still grounded in human emotion. So they come at them from totally opposite directions, but meet in the middle when it comes to characters and humanity.
And just as a curiosity, because I don't think there's a lot of people who have adapted both Stephen King and Clive Barker stories.
Yeah, probably none but me.
No, off the top of my head, I can't think of anybody else. Do you think that emotionality where they do intersect is where you intersect too?
I would like to think so. You know, for me, character definitely comes first. If I'm writing, and I get to a point where I'm having difficulty with where it's going, basically, I just write characters and they will find the story. But that humanity, you know, ideas, unique ideas that both of them have in very rich senses still rotate around the sun of character. And that's something that I found as a reader fascinating in the work of both of them, and discovered them each separately and appreciated them for their own values. And as an adapter, you not only have to have a sense of character and story yourself, but you have to be sort of a chameleon and take on the characteristics of the artist who created the work that you're adapting. So I think that's definitely a part of it. And being such a fan of the books, wanting to pay due respect to what made the books wonderful in the first place. So I'm involved, you know, because I'm writing or directing something based on somebody else's material, you can't help but put your own personality into it. But it's got to be in service of the original work that made it something people wanted to adapt to film or television in the first place.
You have it. Switching gears, a couple industry and craft questions.
Uh-huh.
Mario asks, gents, I'm curious how non-disclosure agreements work. When an actor goes on the talk show circuit or press junkets, are they briefed and or given a script with talking points about what they can or cannot say? And what are the sanctions for loose lips? Can you use one of your past movies as an example of what tea should and shouldn't be spilled?
Well, I've never signed an NDA in my life. And actors think for themselves. To give an actor, especially a successful actor, talking points and walking them through what they should or shouldn't say is a minefield. Joe, I think you have more experience with NDAs than I do. But they basically, it's a non-disclosure agreement where you sign it agreeing not to spill the beans, not to tell what you've discussed in these meetings, what the movie is about. However, I don't think those are used very often in publicity purposes for when a movie comes out. It's really during the course of discussions and production.
My experience with NDAs has only been bad.
They only benefit one side.
That's absolutely correct. And they're usually used to hide bad behavior. I had to sign one of them on one of my produced movies. And it absolutely was to cover up some bad behavior, which I'm still not allowed to talk about.
And I can imagine what movie that was.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure it's not hard to figure out. That's all I can really say about that. On another movie of mine, other people were forced to sign NDAs to prevent them from talking to me about some bad behavior that the producers were trying to carry out. Because they were afraid I was going to go to the Writers Guild and report them, which I would have. they were right to try and, I think... put out that fire, but they were doing it to cover up behavior that was unethical and against my agreement and contract with them. So I again never had good experiences with NDAs, and like we kind of famously heard is during the Me Too movement and in the wake of that, they've only really ever been used to cover up the misdeeds and bad behaviors of upper echelon producers and executives and CEOs.
Now, sometimes they are used to protect the secrecy of a project that's going out there. And that is a valid use for them because you can upend a production or a project and make it not happen if word comes out prematurely or in the wrong sense. So that's an understandable use. But again, I've never had that experience, but that is one purpose for non-disclosure agreements.
Yeah, I feel like that would be really more with like Marvel movies or Star Wars movies or things.
Right, where they are more common.
Yes. I think in that sense, they would probably dictate the publicity matters a little bit more so than say the inner workings of an actual production, which is where I've experienced them. So
yeah, when you've got hundreds of millions of dollars at stake and secrets are important, then that's when a non-DA comes in and has its most value.
Yes. All right, moving on to another industry topic. Rob writes, given the sheer amount of amazing literary horror out there that is now long out of copyright and in the public domain, why aren't we seeing more of these getting developed, given the propensity for built-in fan bases that seems to allay risk-taking fears and execs? It should be the ultimate existing IP in the horror space, but this doesn't seem to be the case. Why?
Well, for something to be out of copyright, copyright lasts 75 years.
Mm-hmm.
So for something to be out of copyright, it had to have been created more than 75 years ago. Horror in the eyes of Hollywood and most producers in the game is very contemporary. It's very much youth oriented. It's very much about younger characters. It's rarely about period pieces. So a good idea 80 years ago may not necessarily transcend. Yeah, there's a lot of great stuff that's out of copyright, things like H.P. Lovecraft, Edgar Allan Poe, and the like. And those things have been made ad infinitum. So I think just the idea of so much of that material by must needs is old, it's less likely to find a home. And a lot of those ideas that were great 90, 100 years ago have been superseded by contemporary ideas and built upon and improved upon or elaborated upon over decades and decades and decades. So I think that's probably the main reason that you don't see older material embraced in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think there's something that's kind of missing to this argument, which is executives are only looking for IP, and that's not necessarily the case. They're looking for IP that has a fan base. And if something is that old and it is not still predominantly in the culture, like say Lovecraft is, it's very hard to argue that you should adapt it just on IP's sake alone, right?
Right. And in the case of somebody like H.P. Lovecraft, he is his own genre, was his own genre. Nobody else was creating the sorts of things he was. And his contemporaries like Arthur Machen and the like came up with brilliant ideas, but are not necessarily adaptable for our contemporary world of filmmaking, which is, as we know, the studio genre films are primarily aimed at teenagers and college age people.
Yeah. When I was still an executive, there was one project at the company I was working at, which was based on a Larry Niven sci-fi novel called Ringworld, which still is very much in copyright, but, you know, had been exploited by so many other science fiction works, Star Wars and Halo, et cetera, that the IP just really didn't feel fresh anymore. And, you know, we constantly get really, really exciting directors and writers who wanted to take stabs at it. But no one could really find their way in because ultimately at the end of the day, it had just been strip mined for parts by so many other things that had come since that there really wasn't a way to get the you know, whether it was sci-fi or Amazon, whoever had it, they've all had it at different points, excited about it. But I do think if you can find a way into old material, I don't think anyone was clamoring for a new Invisible Man movie, right? But Lee Whannell found a really special new take that revitalized an old property.
Yeah, and you know, there's Renfield. They're making Dracula movies all the time. They're making Frankenstein movies still. You know, Birth Rebirth is not officially a Frankenstein remake, but it wouldn't exist if there weren't Frankenstein. Exactly. And Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, they're variations on a theme, body replacement and things like that. And those are themes that continue, but they've been modernized and made much more contemporary and complicated, more complex, because we are so familiar with them. But there are germs of great ideas that can be amplified upon.
Exactly. Exactly. All right. A couple craft questions. Rob writes, "Hello, Mick and Joe. I would love to hear Rob. The ever so eloquent Mr. Garris explain a couple industry terms I keep hearing and don't quite understand. Blocking and set piece are often talked about, but I would like to hear them explained and elaborated on to death. My layman's brain will appreciate the lesson."
Well, let's start with set piece. It just means something that stands alone as a really exciting, you know, it's an action piece. It's a central piece that is not a dialogue scene. It's something that makes you go, wow. Mm-hmm. It's something that can stand on its own in a trailer or a clip on YouTube. You watch this, that set piece is a piece of machinery that works fantastically well in a movie.
Yeah, in a horror movie, it would be all the scares, right?
Yeah, yeah. A set piece is something that you plan elaborately to stand out from the rest of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So blocking is how you arrange the scene to be shot, where the actors go, what door they come through, when they come together to do an over-the-shoulder standing up or sitting down, how you figure out the geography and the choreography of how a scene plays. It's the actors working within their environment and how they use that environment to better and more clearly and more emotionally potently play out the scene. So, you know, just as an example, there's a scene in the Shining miniseries that it's 8 pages long and it's a dialogue scene between Rebecca De Mornay and Steven Weber. She comes down the stairs in a very seductive mode and he's obsessed with the history of the Overlook Hotel. It's nighttime. There's a fire burning. There's blue moonlight coming through the picture windows. So how you orchestrate that, it's first she comes down the stairs. She's at the foot of the stairs. He's already in the room. They're at opposite ends of the room. When you bring them together, eventually they come and sit on a sofa facing one another. But it's manipulated in such a way that he is illuminated by the cold moonlight that's coming in from behind Rebecca. She is illuminated by the warm light coming from the fireplace. So you have this extremely important color spectrum and heat spectrum that feeds into the story being told. And it's where you put them, when you bring them, you sit them close together, but you give them a distance by how they are lit and by the moods you're trying to create. And then when they come apart afterwards, you know, all of that is a bit of a dance that needs to be choreographed. And that was an example where there's no action at all. There's just dialogue communication and non-spoken, non-verbal communication between these two characters who are in the middle of a very, very complicated rift in their relationship, and how you orchestrate that and play that. I think that's blocking.
Yeah, I think it's a great anecdote, and it's actually one that you imparted to me right before I went off and directed The All-Pair Nightmare. So I'm glad you got to share it with everyone else, because it's a great, great example of it. All right. Chris wants to know, Mick and Joe, how do you approach breaking a story?
Well, you know, people use terms like breaking a story and all that. To me, it's just writing, a lot of people work it out with beats. They talk about, you know, every 10 pages, something has to happen, or, you know, a character and his arc and where it has to happen in the story and all that. I think those are things that have been created by screenwriting schools that more than anything are attended by studio executives so that there are rules to follow. When I don't believe in those rules, I have never in my career of some decades sat down and tried to break a story in that way. I'll start at page one and work my way through. Sometimes there will be an outline. If you're working on assignment for a studio, you have to do an outline. You have to do a beat by beat what's going to happen before you embark on writing the screenplay. But if I'm writing on my own, it's something that you learn just through loving movies, watching movies, reading books. It's storytelling that hopefully becomes something that's innate to you as a storyteller. But a lot of people put a lot of work into how rules matter and certain elements have to be followed in order to create the formula of writing a screenplay. And that's a very valid way to approach it. But I've never followed that.
I think it's also a valid way to write a boring screenplay.
Well, I don't disagree. Well, it's how to write a screenplay like every other screenplay.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's they're training wheels, I think of it as.
Well put.
I think one of the reasons I like working with partners on screenplays is I'm a big believer in talking the movie out. I like talking about the characters and the themes and the ideas and like basically what we would call blue skying, brainstorming, until I have a really clear picture of what the movie is, and then start laying it out on paper. You know, there's a project I've been working on for the last several months. And you know, before we started writing it, there was, you know, there were phases where we were turning documents into the producers, outlines and treatments and such, but kind of in the, you know, precursor to that, there was, you know, several weeks of just talking through what the movie could be, what we wanted it to feel like, what movies we were trying to capture, you know, how we could do it, how we could make it our own. I think all of those things have to happen for me to be able to actually determine if there's a movie there.
Well, that's breaking a story.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So once I have those things in place, it becomes very easy and clear to put it down on paper. But for me, sometimes I talk through these ideas and I go, wow, maybe there wasn't actually a movie there, you know? So I find that generative process to be helpful, because by the time I put it through its paces, by bouncing it back and forth for however many weeks we do, I usually have a pretty good sense of whether or not it's worth investing another, you know, 2 to 6 months into the screenplay. Right. So that's how I do it. But Mick and I kind of come at it from different ways, but I think ultimately at the end of the day, it's finding the things that you're passionate about exploring. Right.
Yeah. And when I'm writing on my own, I don't care about what time it takes. And, you know, if I'm rewriting or changing something or going, oh, here's an idea and I can go back and do it, I don't have anybody else that I have to share that with. And I just like starting on page one, walking the tightrope without a neck.
Yeah, I do not do that, but I admire those who are brave enough to do it. I again, through my kind of, you know, talking it out process, I have a good sense of where the movie is going before I start writing. And, you know, I think I try not to flesh it out. This happens, this happens, this happens, this happens, because I still want those sparks of inspiration to come in the connective tissue.
Oh, the discovery that happens when your intuition feeds the process is thrilling.
Yeah. Yeah. That's where you get the good stuff. So, yeah. So, you know, everyone's got their own process, and I think Mick and I have very different ones, but, you know, at the end of the day, we both will end up with a 90 to 100 page document. So
exactly. That nobody's going to buy. No,
that's not always true. Just
no, sometimes. No. But the fact is, as much as you want it to happen and can help it to become realized, you have to realize that there's a really good possibility that nobody's going to buy it, and not think of it as a waste of time, but the opportunity to practice your craft and get better and to do it again. Yep. And have another sample of what you can do.
Exactly. Every script you learn something, and every script is worth writing. So, okay. Last question, Mick.
Okay.
The last question of the last Ask Mick Anything. Tim writes, with the show ending, it seemed the perfect opportunity to ask. I was curious to know exactly how and when you both first crossed paths and why Mick decided to bring Joe along for the postmortem adventure. What qualities made you want to collaborate with each other? What do you feel both connects you as film professionals and fans of cinema and the horror genre? What have you learned from one another? Your fondness and mutual respect for one another is very obvious and has been a strong foundation for your consistently engaging discussions.
Well, thank you for the very, very kind and generous words. Really appreciate that. It kind of worked in reverse. I mean, Joe and I first met when he was a studio executive for a production company, and we had a general meeting and hit it off there. And we had a couple of
those.
David
Harris was the person who connected us.
Yes, David Harris put us together. And we are forever grateful. He also helped work us toward the Nightmare Cinema.
That's right. Yep. Getting made. Yeah, and he's an associate producer on that movie.
Yeah.
Yep.
So But what happened was, and maybe Joe should tell it, but I'll start it, is Joe was at a party.
Yep.
And one of the executives from Podcast One, which is the biggest podcast company in the world, was there. And they talked about the idea. I had done Postmortem as a TV series for FearNet, or Peter Block. And we'd done 10 of the episodes with people like William Friedkin, John Carpenter, Toby Hooper, Wes Craven. And the idea was there. And it was Joe's idea to pitch it as a podcast. I had never thought of doing that. But they were very receptive. And then we met with the owner of the company, Norm Pattiz, who has since been deceased. But he was the owner of Westwood One, which is the biggest radio syndication company at that time. He sold it off for a fortune and started Podcast One instead. So, Joe, you want to take it from there?
Yeah, I mean, you and I were already in development. I think we were doing our deal to get Nightmare Cinema into production by this point. So we were already working together when the Postmortem opportunity presented itself. It's kind of crazy. I mean, we started the podcast. The first podcast launched maybe a month before we started shooting Nightmare Cinema. I mean,
yeah, was it close? Wow.
It was a busy couple weeks, boy. and I also, that was, and it was, we started the podcast in January 2017. I had shot that Crypt TV Valentine's Day short, and we started production on Nightmare Cinema at the end of February. It was like the wildest 8 weeks ever. but you know, that was how it came together. Was Mick said, I just off the cuff pitched it to this podcast executive. I felt like I'd had enough people pitch me movie ideas that had enough karma bank to pitch a podcast. And you know, and Mick's right, they bought it hook, line, and sinker. I think that process started in September 2016, and the show was up and running by January 2017. It was all very fast.
Well, what was amazing about it was I thought we were going to be pitching them a show, and Norm Pattiz was pitching us on his company.
Yeah.
And, you know, they had people like Adam Carolla. And telling me things like, you know, Adam Carolla gets $7.5 million a year from his podcast, as if I were going to benefit from it. The first
I think they hoped the horror community had a bigger podcast reach than it ultimately did.
Yeah, but I made that 1 year, 10 months that we were with Podcast One, I made $500 total.
Yeah, it was.
So you don't do podcasting out of the love of it, but you know, we've had four different homes, starting with Podcast One. Then we had Fangoria, we had Blumhouse, and then the last couple of years with Dread Central.
Yeah.
So
I think Sean Merrick, who from Podcast One, we owe a great deal of gratitude because he really helped establish the sound and format of the show.
It was interesting because they have these really fancy studios in Beverly Hills, and that's where we did our show all the time.
You know, and I think over the years it's evolved, and when we moved over to Fangoria and Chris Price took over the engineering, he helped us kind of become more nimble on our feet, and we were able to keep the show going, I think, because we were able to produce it much cheaper than Podcast One.
I mean, at Blumhouse, we did it in their
conference room.
Conference room. Which led to problems occasionally.
Yeah, when Jason would walk in and be like, what the fuck's going on?
I remember a Steven Weber interview being cut short because Jason was commandeering the conference room for a meeting.
Well, luckily we had Steven back on. You know, we made it up to him. But I mean, the show's evolved over the years, and I've been very grateful that and that's right. And we survived COVID. We were nimble on our feet and pivoted to Zoom. And
Joe and I love movies. And you know, that is evident. And being able to talk two ways about movies and not particularly the AMAs, Joe, is such an important ingredient in that regard. And we've come to have great conversations back and forth about this. And I've watched Joe's career amplify, you know, as kind of a beginner in having success in getting movies optioned and then made. You know, it's been exciting to watch him. I kind of feel like the tutor in a way.
Well, but you have been. I mean, you've been there every step of the way. Every time I've needed advice, Mick's always been a text or a phone call away, and has helped me through some sticky situations and helped me through just some really creatively rewarding ones. And I'm forever grateful for Nightmare Cinema and Postmortem allowing us to become friends and giving me those amazing opportunities to pick his brain.
Yeah, well, it's been quite the run. We're not done yet. We've got a couple more to go, and we have a bit of an extravaganza that we'll be going out on, but we can't talk about it yet.
Yes, hopefully very soon you'll all learn about it. Maybe earmark December 9th if you're in the LA area. We'll be bringing the show home with some fireworks. So
yeah, and we've got at least one more terrific guest. Hopefully, if everything works out with the schedule, we have two more real great headline guests.
We will see what happens. But whatever the case, the one we have in the can is a wonderful interview that all our fans are going to be very excited for.
So, exactly.
Mick, thank you so much for doing the show and doing the show with me and allowing me to become part of it.
Joe, thank you for doing such a great job and kicking it off in the first place, getting it going.
It was my pleasure and something I really, truly am incredibly proud of. So
forgive me the sin of pride in joining you. And even more importantly, thank you for an audience that allowed us to continue this. I don't want this to sound like the last show, because it's not. It's just the last AMA.
Yeah.
But to allow us 7 years of conversations that I've learned from every single one of them. You know, we've gotten insights from people that you'd never get anywhere else, from people who mean a lot to the audience in the horror genre. And it's just been an amazing list of guests that I don't think anybody could supersede.
Well, Mick, I think all that's left to say is onward and upward with the arts.
And thank you to Christopher Leon Price.
And John Holland and Jeff Gelb and John Jasinski, all the people we have in our credits.
And Bill Burney, yes.
Yes, exactly.
We've got a core group of really important people for this show. And most importantly, the audience who's hung in there year after year.
Mick, thank you. And that has been Ask Mick Anything.
Thanks a lot, Joe.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Postmortem with Mick Garris is produced by Mick Garris and Joe Russo. Our sound engineer is Christopher Leon Price. Our announcer is Jeff Gelb. Our graphic designer is John Holland. And our theme was composed and performed by Bill Burney with additional music by John Jasinski. If you're enjoying our show, please take a moment to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.